to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I am your host for today, Susan Franzen. Thanks for joining us. Today's show is about rights. Rights some of us take for granted, but which are unjustly denied to others. This past Monday, the American Civil Liberties Union and the League of Women Voters held a rally in the rotunda at the state capitol to urge the Iowa Senate to move forward with legislation that would restore voting eligibility to tens of thousands of Iowans who cannot vote because of felony convictions. Iowa is the last state in the country to deny voting rights to people who were convicted of a felony and have completed serving their time in prison. The goal of the ACLU is for the legislature to change the state constitution to end this ban, which they see as a form of voter suppression. Recently, the ACLU and KHOI collaborated to produce a podcast to inform you about this issue. Let's take a listen.
Welcome to Our Liberties, We Podcast, a joint effort of the ACLU of Iowa and KHOI Community Radio in Ames, Iowa. In each episode, we tackle a different civil liberties issue that affects our state and interview experts from the ACLU of Iowa, as well as Iowans who are impacted by these issues. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, station manager at KHOI, and I'm going to be your host. Today, we're talking about felony disenfranchisement in Iowa and the impact it has on the very cornerstone of democracy in our state. Iowa is now the last state in the country that permanently and for life strips Iowans of their right to vote if they're convicted of any felony. Until recently, the other state was Kentucky, but its new governor issued an executive order to change that. Other states restore a person's right to vote after a felony, after they serve the terms of their sentence or probation. Vermont and Maine never take away this constitutional right. That's because felony disenfranchisement is increasingly being recognized as a form of voter suppression, which is why the ACLU of Iowa and the NAACP, the League of Women Voters, and many other advocacy groups are working so hard to change Iowa's law on this. There are different ways to restore the vote for people with convictions. The ACLU and other groups have been trying to get change through the legal system, including two cases that went before the Iowa Supreme Court with mixed success. So they turned to the legislative branch, advocating for a bill in the Iowa legislature that would change the Iowa law. In January 2019, in something of a surprise move, Governor Kim Reynolds announced that one of her priorities would be to restore voting rights for Iowans with felony convictions by pushing for legislation that would change the Iowa Constitution to specify that people with felony convictions can indeed vote. And Governor Reynolds has reaffirmed that commitment this year as well. With us today is Daniel Zeno, ACLU of Iowa Policy Director. He spends a lot of time at the State House talking with legislators and with other policymakers and managing the legislative program of the ACLU of Iowa. So, Daniel, how many people are affected by felony disenfranchisement? How many people in Iowa right now can't vote because they have a felony conviction in their background?
The estimates we have are over 60,000 people, and the number is growing, who don't have the right to vote because they were convicted of a felony. Now, that's the people who are directly impacted. Those people have lost their right to vote. We also know that there's an impact on the families, the communities. So that number is actually bigger than the 60,000. It's the people who are connected to those 60,000 people. And we don't have an estimate of that number, right? So it's a lot of people who are impacted by not being able to vote in Iowa because of a felony conviction.
And why do you think it's important to change things for these people? Why does that really matter?
It really matters because it's about ensuring that we can all participate in our democracy, right? It's about saying we aren't going to exclude certain people for the rest of their lives, right? People who committed a crime were convicted of a crime. They were convicted of a felony. There are consequences in the criminal justice system when you commit a crime and you're convicted. One of the consequences should not be, and we exclude you from democracy for the rest of your life. You can't vote for the mayor of your town, the people on your school board, the governor of your state, right? We shouldn't do that to people. What we should be doing is including as many people as possible. All the people who are eligible to vote should be able to vote, even if they've done something that is wrong and that is bad and that there are consequences for.
And a felony, just to be clear, isn't some of the more serious crimes people automatically think of. It can be something as small as stealing an expensive bike or video game. Let's talk about the racial impact of this law. Iowa has a very high incarceration rate for African Americans, one of the worst in the country.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So in Iowa, African Americans make up about 3% of the state population.
And that's because of a number of complex factors, including inequities in our criminal justice system. I think a good example of that inequity was the ACLU study of law enforcement data from a few years ago that found a black person in Iowa is 8 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession, even though other studies indicate that white people and black people use marijuana at about the same rate. But the bottom line is that African Americans, wrongly, are convicted of felonies at a much higher rate, to their voting rights being taken away at a much higher rate.
And so while voting disenfranchisement is an important issue that we're talking about today, because the disproportionate number of African Americans who are put through the criminal justice system or convicted of a felony, criminal justice reform and sort of that work is directly connected to how do we address felony disenfranchisement.
It's a bigger context.
Yes.
Yeah. Studies show that punishing people further actually has a detrimental effect on society because recidivism rates and getting invested in their community is hurt.
Yeah. So felony disenfranchisement not only impacts a person's voting rights, right? They can't vote if they're convicted of a felony. It also doesn't do anything to help community engagement. They have served their time. They've been released from incarceration. They've completed parole, probation, whatever. They are working to pay off their fines, fees. And then the government, society, telling people convicted of a felony, yeah, but you're never going to be able to vote. You are never going to be able to participate in that process that everybody else in your community can participate. You're never going to have the opportunity to take your children, your family members, your people who are connected to you, who are younger than you, take them to the polls to show them how interesting and exciting and useful it is to vote, right? And so the real detriment we do to individuals and communities and families when we say to people, you can't vote for the rest of your life is really, really, really bad.
I've also seen statistics that 1 in 10 African Americans of voting age are currently barred from voting for life. That's really disturbing. If laws don't change, that number can be expected to increase to 1 in 4, taking away the choice of even more people of color.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right.
Why do you think that we as Iowans are the last ones to deal with this or to look at this?
I don't know. There are lots of things, lots of factors. In Iowa in particular, this is in stark contrast to lots of other areas of civil rights where Iowa has been a leader.
Mm-hmm.
Marriage for same-sex couples. In the 1800s, Iowa desegregated schools before Brown v. Board of Education. So Iowa's been a leader on lots of civil rights issues, civil liberties issues. Unfortunately, on this issue, Iowa's not at the back. Iowa's all the way at the end of the line.
So if you're someone who has a felony, even though your right to vote has been taken away from you for life, there is a process in which you can apply to the governor's office to individually get your voting right back. You fill out an application, and the governor's office has said they will do everything they can to process and approve these applications.
Right. So on the one hand, that's a good thing. On the other hand, there are about 60,000 people, and the number is growing because every new person that's convicted of a felony, that person's added to the list.
The number.
There are about 60,000 people in Iowa, and since 2011, about 300 people have had their voting rights restored.
Wow, that's right. A very, very small percentage.
Yes.
I don't even know what percent that is, but
I think
it's insignificant.
Less than 1%.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But Governor Reynolds could just issue an executive order and fix this immediately with a stroke of the pen. Why do you think she doesn't do that?
So that is true. The governor has the power to issue an executive order that theoretically would restore voting rights for everybody. A couple of reasons why we think that's not the optimal thing to do right now. One, there's a constitutional amendment that's in the Iowa legislature, House Joint Resolution 14, or HJR 14. That passed the Iowa House of Representatives 95-2 in the 2019
that's
session.
That's remarkable.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's now in the Iowa Senate, so we still got some work to do. We are working to change the Iowa Constitution because that's the permanent way you fix this problem. The governor could issue an executive order. One, that would be a temporary fix because the governor could always change her own executive order. Any new governor could issue a new executive order, right? So it's a temporary fix. And a second reason that it's probably not optimal for the governor to issue an executive order is if the governor were to issue an executive order now, the constitutional amendment would die.
Oh,
because legislators would say, the governor just fixed it. Mm-hmm. We have an executive order, right? And then another reason is in the past, there have been two executive orders. There was an executive order in 2005 by then-Governor Vilsack. There was another one in 2011 by then-Governor Branstad. In addition to those two executive orders, the application itself has changed 3 to 4 times. Every time there's a new executive order, a new application, what it does is moves the goalposts.
That's right.
And then people are confused because they don't know, well, what am I supposed to do now? Because now the rules are changed. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, most people aren't following executive orders issued by the governor, right? When was the last time you knew that the governor issued an executive order? Which, by the way, happens relatively frequently, but people don't follow executive orders, right? So there are lots of reasons why we think fixing the Constitution is the way to permanently right this wrong, to permanently say, we are not going to do this in Iowa anymore. And it's not going to depend on who's in the governor's office. It'll be in the Iowa Constitution saying, we're not going to do this. Mm-hmm.
Now, some legislators have reservations about eliminating the felony disenfranchisement, and they talk a lot about making it dependent on repaying restitution.
The current process, when a person applies to get their voting rights back in Iowa right now, they have to say that they are on a payment plan for their fines, fees, restitution, right? They don't have to have it all paid off. And that's important because for lots of people who are convicted of a felony, saying that you have to pay off all your fines and fees and penalties would mean they would never get their right to vote back. An example, Iowa law says any person who's convicted of a crime that results in the death of another person, there is a mandatory minimum $150,000 restitution that the person is ordered to pay. So one of the people that connected with the ACLU and our advocacy work in the legislature, his name is Rick Stadler, a real life story. It's from Southeast Iowa. He was convicted of a felony. The crime he committed resulted in the death of another person. And so he's been ordered to pay $150,000 in victim restitution. He is in his, I believe, mid to late 60s. Fortunately, he was able to find a job after he was released from incarceration. And he is on a payment plan. He is paying victim restitution. He has said he will not be able to pay off that amount of money in his lifetime. He's paying. He has said, I know I did something wrong. I know there should be consequences, and I am paying. But if we say you have to pay off your full fines, fees, and restitution, Rick Sadler and others will not ever be able to vote, mm-hmm. right? That would also mean a person who has more money could just write one check, and they'd have their right to vote back, right? Mm-hmm. To be clear, victim restitution is a really important policy area, and we are happy to talk through and help educate legislators and advocate to think about how do we fix victim restitution if there are issues with it, because we know victims of crime suffer, right? What we shouldn't be doing is saying because one person has suffered, let's make another person suffer for the rest of their lives, right? Mm-hmm. What we should be doing is how do we make this better? How do we figure out a way that the person who's convicted of the felony can make the payments that they are ordered to pay, can get a job, can vote? That's what we should be doing. How do we help the victim feel safe? And saying to the person convicted of a felony, you can't vote, doesn't do that. That doesn't get us there.
Okay. Thank you, Daniel Zeno, ACLU of Iowa Policy Director. Finally, what can someone do if they're concerned about this and wants to get involved?
So, like I said, there's a bill in the Iowa legislature right now, House Joint Resolution 14, or HJR 14, that would fix this problem. And so one thing people can do is contact their state legislator, their state senator in particular, and
so
urge
this is about
them.
State senators.
Yes. So it passed the Iowa House last year.
So it's
so
the
we
Senate.
Need it to get through the state Senate. So contact your state senator to urge them to vote yes on House Joint Resolution 14.
House Joint Resolution 14.
Yes, absolutely. Also sign up for the ACLU of Iowa email alerts at aclu-ia.org. And people can sign up on our website to stay up to date on what's happening in the legislature, aclu-ia.org. Absolutely. Calls or emails or if people can, you know, sit down for coffee with your legislator now, that would be really helpful before the session starts when things get busy and legislators are busier. It's helpful if people are able to do that now. And if there are people who are convicted of a felony who are able to and are willing to talk to their legislator and tell their own story, that's really helpful. Because what it does is it helps legislators understand that this is not just a policy issue. This is about real people and their lives and what it means for the people and their families and their communities. And so anything we can do to help fix this problem is a good thing. Those of us who have the right to vote, we also have an obligation. We have an obligation to fix this problem because where we are right now is there are people who can't vote. There are people who can't vote out legislators who don't want to fix this problem or support legislators who want to fix this problem. We can do that, right? And so those of us who can vote have an obligation to do what we can do to right this wrong. So one thing people can do is contact their state legislator. The bill, House Joint Resolution 14, passed the Iowa House in 2019. It will be in the Iowa Senate in 2020. So we really need people to contact their state senator. The bill needs to go through the Senate Judiciary Committee. And so if you live in a district where your senator is on the Senate Judiciary Committee, contact your senator, urge them to vote yes in committee. And then for all of us across the state, the bill will then go to the full Senate. So every single one of us can contact our own senator to urge our senator to vote yes when it comes to the Senate floor.
Thank you, Daniel. Daniel Zeno is the ACLU of Iowa Policy Director, and I'm Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening to Our Liberties We podcast, a joint effort of the ACLU of Iowa and KHOI Community Radio in Ames, Iowa.
Before we leave this topic of prison, I'd like to play the song that I most clearly associate from my youth with a movie about prison. This was actually, I just learned, about a progressive prison in California. It's Unchained, and let's listen to it.
Only time. Wait for me, wait for me.
case you just tuned in, that was Unchained Melody from the 1955 movie Unchained. That song was actually sung in a prison barracks, supposedly by a prisoner, about the loneliness of prison life. And that was a follow-up to an interview with ACLU's Danielle Zeno about changing the laws in Iowa so that there is the possibility of an amendment to the Iowa Constitution, which would restore voting rights to persons convicted of felonies. So that's something to be aware of. The second story about rights is an international story. I'd like to take a moment to thank Gail Seiler, former local talk host who has moved from Ames, but sent us this story from the New York Times. It's about a number of Iranian students who were denied entry to the United States and the universities that were expecting them. One of these students, Mala, an industrial engineering graduate student at Iowa State University. Before we talk to people here in Ames, I'd like to read her account from the Times. Mala said she was questioned about her work, family, and many other things. This is in Logan Airport where she's waiting to go through customs. The officer said the company she worked for, which produces plastic packing materials, had relationships with companies in Iran's oil sector. Quote, "The officer said his boss didn't like that I had worked with that company," unquote, she said. She could not understand why one officer's opinion of her company would take precedence over a months-long visa process. Quote, "If I was eligible to receive a visa after such a time-consuming process, after they had investigated all my information, why was I not allowed to enter the U.S.?" End quote. What I wanted to learn was how Mala's being sent back to Iran was viewed by those who were expecting her here. To learn that, I called Gary Mirka, professor of industrial and manufacturing systems engineering at Iowa State University. Here's what he told me.
My name is Gary Mirka, and I'm professor in the Department of Industrial and Manufacturing Systems Engineering at Iowa State University. And I'm the director of research and the director of graduate education for our department. And so I interact several times a year with international graduate applicants that are interested in joining our graduate program here in our department.
About what proportion of your students are international?
In our PhD program, the majority of those students are international. Probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 80% of our PhD students are international students.
What countries do they come from?
We have students from Iran, China, India, Korea. The biggest bulk of our international students come from those countries.
Well, the reason that I'm calling you today is because one of your students was turned back at Logan Airport. Are you familiar with this case and this student, and who is she?
Yes, I am familiar with the case. The student's first name is Mala, and that's just what we call her because of the difficulty in pronouncing the last name.
So Mala, when was she supposed to arrive?
Well, the original plan, she had applied at about this time last year for a fall arrival, and the process of getting the visa for the fall arrival was delayed to the point where she wasn't able to join us in the fall semester. And so we deferred her admission to the spring 2020 semester. So we were expecting her to arrive in late December to join our program in January.
And what happened in late December?
Well, as I understand it, she had all the materials she needed. She got on the plane. She flew to Boston, Logan Airport, and apparently there was interaction there with the customs folks, and she was denied entry at that point.
I learned about this from an article in the New York Times, which was published in January, and there were many universities that had students with similar problems. Did Iowa State have any others?
Not that I'm aware of. At the time that I learned that there was one of our students that had been stopped, I called over to our International Students and Scholars Office and asked them if this was a widespread thing here, and they had mentioned that at that time, at least, that was the only case that they were aware of.
Does this create a problem for you?
Well, we count on graduate students to arrive. We have research that we recruit these students to participate in, and so when a student doesn't arrive, it becomes a challenge for the professors to do the research that they're involved in.
Well, going forward, does this create problems?
Well, it's unclear whether this is a trend or if this was just a one-off situation. We are in the process right now of recruiting graduate students for the fall semester of this year, 2020, and we're continuing our process as we always have, which includes students from around the world.
We here at KHOI have a volunteer, actually the president of our board, who came to the U.S., came to Iowa State in the 70s as a graduate student in engineering. And so this raised the question for me, have we had a steady stream of women engineering graduate students?
Well, it depends on the major within the College of Engineering. Industrial engineering has often been a place where we have a large proportion of our students are women. And so that has been the trend for us for some time.
Is the training they get in Iran a good undergraduate training as far as you're concerned?
Yes, it's excellent. There are a couple of very fine universities there that train the students very well, both at the undergraduate and then the students that we're recruiting into our PhD program typically arriving with a master's degree. And the training they're getting there prepares them very well for success in our program.
Why do you have so many graduate students, international graduate students, instead of Americans?
Well, the undergraduate students that we have, some of them do go on for graduate school, but many of them are able to find excellent jobs with their bachelor's degree, and not all the students are interested in a career in research. So if they're interested in research, they'll often stay in the program beyond their bachelor's degree, but many of them find excellent careers just using the engineering skills that they learn. And so they aren't enthusiastic necessarily right after graduation of spending more time in school when they have such a good option otherwise. One thing I could say is that, you know, the process that these international students have to go through to get their visa is quite significant. And so, you know, it's a quite an ordeal for them, and they, you know, I'm astonished at the level of enthusiasm that they have for coming to the United States to pursue graduate studies and what they're prepared to do to accomplish that.
Well, one thing that you do that I don't think has always been done in the past, you have Skype calls to make sure that if they have classes to teach, because they, most of them get research assistantships or teaching assistantships, is that right?
That's correct. So we have a process whereby my graduate committee reviews all the applicants, and then for those PhD students that meet the requirements on paper, we go through a process of doing Skype interviews with those folks. So we talk with them for 15 minutes, and we evaluate their English skills to assess whether they would be effective in the classroom, understandable in the classroom, and then also explore with them what their research interests are and how those might be effectively employed to help our professors conduct the research that they're doing.
Well, thank you very much. I think this is a very, very informative interview. I really appreciate your taking the time for this. So
you're welcome. You have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we just heard from Gary Mirka, professor of Industrial and Manufacturing Systems Engineering at Iowa State University. To continue our story, we're turning to Fran Amin, an Iranian engineer who came to ISU to study in 1976 and has studied and worked in Ames ever since. In 1976, relations between Iran and the United States were particularly good, with Iran ruled, as it had been since 1941, by a monarchy under the control of Shah Reza Pahlavi, who was westernizing the country and providing cheap oil to the West. In 1977 and 78, demonstrations broke out and were brutally suppressed by the Shah's army. He was forced to flee and was replaced by the Ayatollah Khomeini, the spiritual leader of the Iranian Revolution, who had been in exile for 15 years and was quickly declared supreme leader. The deep cultural split within the population between Islamic nationalists and westernizers has occupied much of the history of the succeeding 40 years, and Fran gives us an unusual perspective, especially regarding the position of women.
So I was not there when the revolution took place, which kind of started in 1977, maybe in 1978. And in 1979, the regime actually changed, which I think it's about the same time, around this time, that, Khomeini took, the power and Shah left. So it was about 3 years after I had already left Iran. But so it didn't really affect me in terms of I'm here at Iowa State University, but definitely affected my family back home, relatives, my mom, my brothers, sisters. And the first few years was so horrible, the stuff that you heard constantly, because a lot of people who were not happy with the Shah, they did a lot of damage in terms of, going and looting, the palaces. A lot of people were killed, or actually the regime, was killing a lot of supporters of the Shah, or, sometimes maybe even innocent people, were killed.
We heard that people who were not Muslims or not conservative Muslims were being killed, like the Baha'is.
Right, Baha'is, yeah. And a lot of them were just denying, basically that, they're not Muslim. A lot of them left Iran, and it was, complete chaos then. And these things that you hear happened over years. It did not happen right away. Even hijab, Iranians don't wear burqa. Burqa is Afghanistan. But hijab, covering their, that was like maybe a couple of years after the revolution that they said, little by little, first it was women who worked, they have to do this. And then, people or girls or women who were going to school. And at some point it was just, you wouldn't dare to, stoning. They were strictly, the regime at the beginning, I think, was strictly going with the Sharia or the law of Islam, it was terrible. It was, the stories that we heard was just out of this world. We couldn't believe that these things are happening in Iran. But little by little, because people were very unhappy, people would not even go out anymore probably. I didn't get to go back until my family said that it's okay. It took like 8 years because, Iran and Iraq were fighting also. The war started at 1980 and took until 1988. So it was the first time I went there, I couldn't believe the way that people even treated each other, and the way it was completely different. It was not the country that I left. So right now, it's probably in certain areas might not be as bad as far as the restrictions on certain things, especially when it comes to women. They don't make it very difficult for them that, with their hijab or makeup and clothes, they were just so, strict about these things that they would actually had these vans, minivans, that they would drive around town. And if they saw somebody who's not following the, you know, hijab rule, they would just put him in the van and took him to somewhere that they wouldn't, I mean, the family would had no way of knowing where they're, you know, taking this woman or where she is. So kind of basically would disappear. And, you know, after maybe a few days, you know, they would let her go. But it was so scary. You had to constantly watch yourself and, you know. And now I think it's not, as far as the, you know, country's concerned and the people and the economy, it's not any better. It's by far worse than.
During the Shah, there was a real liberalization of dress and customs. Did that mean that there were a lot of jobs that opened up for women because men weren't there to do them?
No. There's always been a shortage of jobs. Actually, in the, you know, beginning of the revolution, women were encouraged, sometimes a little bit more than encouragement, that, you know, sometimes they just let them go. Said, okay, go home, you're done. I mean, you can't work anymore here because there's a shortage of jobs and men are supposed to work and women are supposed to be home taking care of kids and just be a woman. Women were not supposed to do certain jobs. A woman judge, that was not permitted because in Islam, women cannot judge, you know, cannot be a judge. And there was, you know, like a man gynecologist was not supposed to examine a woman.
Were there mostly just women's colleges, or were the colleges coeducational?
No, it's coeducational. I think there are, or at least when I was there, I know that there was one college that it was all women. And it was not because, you know, there was, you know, they were, you know, strict about anything. It was just happened that it was a girls' school. But they could not, you know, change the other universities and colleges to make it, you know, all men or all women. But I know that men and women, and I don't know if it's still like that or not, they sat in classrooms separately. But I think one of the reasons that women probably study these disciplines is probably, first of all, the world needs more technology and everything, and women are as smart as any boy or man, and they're interested in it, they can do it, and maybe this is just complete guess, that maybe this is a way for them to get out of the country. Because I don't think they necessarily study these things to stay, you know, in Iran. A lot of them want to pursue the degrees, you know, if it's an undergrad at home, they want to go to graduate school, you know, get master's or PhD and everything. And here, you know, we have so many graduate students in engineering that I was surprised when I saw them first.
So there hasn't been a rise or fall. They're just sort of city state.
So I think it's just, I don't know. I really don't have an answer for you on why, but it's great.
Thank you, Fran. That's an impressive story. And I'd just like to add that my daughter, who was a graduate in the early 80s in civil engineering at ISU, was often the only woman in her classes. And that's in the 80s. While there were lots of women engineers in Tehran, not only before the revolution, but after the revolution. Different picture of Iran.
This is Local Talk, and it's time to shift to a more romantic close. And for Local Talk,
Wednesday, that usually has to do with theater. And we have Lori Haynes with us from the Boone Community Theater to tell us about the very busy few weeks coming up on their schedule. They just opened Sabrina Fair as their Valentine show last week, but it has another weekend to run, so maybe those who missed it will appreciate knowing about it. Hi, Lori.
Thanks for having us on your show.
Well, you have a lot to talk about, even though we don't get to promo your opening. How did your first weekend go?
Oh, it was so great. Valentine's Day, we had a full house, and everyone was so responsive, laughing, and even a couple tears shed. You know, there's just, it's a moving, funny, romantic comedy. So it went over very well. And we have another weekend to come. So we're hoping that more people will come see it.
So now the times are a little different. What are the times on your second
That's
weekend?
That's right. On Friday, February 21st, it's a 7 p.m. show. And this is at the First Evangelical Free Church in Boone on their multipurpose room stage. That's at 1407 Kate Shelley Drive in Boone. It's at 7 p.m. on Friday, but then on Saturday, we're offering a 2 p.m. matinee. We found that an afternoon matinee works really well this time of year because sometimes the weather's not cooperative and people don't want to drive at night. So a 2 o'clock matinee on Saturday, the 22nd.
For those who might be enticed to go, are there any – you have some perks left over from Valentine's Day, don't you?
Yes, we do. This show is being presented with patrons sitting around round tables, and we're offering complimentary drinks, teas, and coffees with various gourmet flavorings for everyone who is in attendance. But for those who want to step it up a notch with the romance, we have premium desserts. We have a dark chocolate with cherry cake or a pink ombre with strawberry cream layered cake. And you can choose between those two, chocolate-covered strawberry and a fresh rose. All of that is with a ticket upgrade. We'll have a limited amount of those, so we kind of recommend that a person contact the theater if they want the upgrade, so we're sure to save you the flavor of cake you'd like.
So how do people contact the theater?
Oh, you can go to boonecommunitytheater.org online and get tickets. And another way is to just call or text the theater's number at 515-303-0393. And that will let us know to expect you, and we'll reply within 24 hours and let you know we got your message. That, again, is 515-303-0393. And tickets are available at the door. There may be some ticket upgrades available. So, you know, if it doesn't happen that you reserve in advance and still come in the door and we have premium desserts available, you're welcome to partake with us.
And for those who are looking for your website, it's you do spell the theater with an
T-H-E-A-T-R-E, but it will... I believe that once you put in Boone Community T-H-E, it will probably pop up with the rest of it.
So
we also have a Facebook page. So search for us on Facebook, too. Yeah. That will give you a link to the theater's website.
And having visited your Facebook page, I know you have some previews on your Facebook page.
Yeah, we have several of our actors have given kind of their background about their character. Sabrina is played by Dana Cokejohn, and she is so perfect in this role. She plays the vivacious and energetic yet charming Sabrina, who, if you're not familiar with the story, is the chauffeur for a wealthy family. His daughter is Sabrina, and she was this mousy, quiet girl growing up, and now she has come back after going to college and working overseas, and she is just totally changed. And kind of shakes up this wealthy family just a little bit. So it's a fun story.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned your actors, because the next event that I think would you'd probably be promoting is an audition that's next week.
Yes.
Could you tell people about that?
Yeah, on Monday and Tuesday, February 24th and 25th, we're having auditions for A Murder is Announced, which is based on Agatha Christie's novels. And Gary Gardner and Brandon Windus are co-directing this murder mystery. And the auditions are 7 o'clock to 8:30 or 9 o'clock at night. You can come either day, Monday or Tuesday. And that is at our theater office at 705 Story Street in Boone. That's 705 Story Street. And we are looking for 7 women and 5 men. And that ranges from young teen or, well, older teen to quite elderly. There's a variety of parts, characters. Of course, the infamous Miss Marple will be one of the fun parts. And just, you know, it's Agatha Christie, so it's a twisted trail that it will take audiences on. So I think it would be a fun play to be involved with.
Well, having gone to several community theater plays in various towns, I've noticed that often their characters come from outside that particular theater region.
Oh, yes.
So... do you often get people from this side of the listening area or Ames?
Oh, often. Yes, we almost always have somebody from Ames involved with our shows. In fact, the current show, Sabrina Fair, Pamela Webster, who is the director, lives in Ames currently. And a few, I would say almost every show has had at least one person from Ames involved. We've had people from as far away as Perry, Gowrie, Jefferson involved in our shows. So we're not limited to just Boone or Boone County. It's open. It's an open audition. So we try to find the best person for each part, and the chemistry of the actors working together. That's also part of it, too. You know, we want to see how they play off of each other. And so that's part of the audition process, is to put different people together and switch them up and see who will evolve into that character.
So that's coming up. And when will that be produced?
We are still trying to secure a stage to produce it on. So it is tentatively set for the end of April, early May. So April 24th, 25th, and then like April 31st, May 1st, and May 2nd is what we've set on the calendar at this point, but that may change depending on which venue we're able to secure in the next week or two.
What kind of a stage do you need? Why can't you just go back to the church you are having Sabrina Fair?
Well, once we get into April, May, there are many more activities at the churches, and we also don't want to overstay our welcome at any one place. So we have already had, you know, this one show at First Evangelical, and they've been so cooperative. But we've also been at First Presbyterian, Central Christian Church, Open Bible Church. We've been at a lot of different places, and we try to not impose on any one venue. So that's why we're exploring a couple other venues for this next show.
Well, good luck.
Yeah, it's a process because, you know, once you're getting closer to spring and events and prom and, you know, all those things, the churches tend to have a lot of activities going on at them.
But you do have something else for young people, Spring Break Youth Camp. Yeah, what's that?
Yeah, this is something new. Normally we have had a summer camp, but this time we're doing a Spring Break Camp. It's 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. March 16th through the 20th. But sign up for it is coming up very soon. We need kids to sign up by this Friday, the 21st, if they're interested. We have 5 spots left. We're only offering this for 20 kids because each person will have a part in the play Squirrel Girl Goes to College. It's based on the Marvel comic character Squirrel Girl. And what's going to happen during camp is that the students will be educated about theater dynamics and how to produce a play in the morning, and then in the afternoon, it'll be practice. And then on Friday evening, March 20th, is a one-night-only performance of Squirrel Girl Goes to College, with the students from the spring break camp putting on the whole production.
Now, did you say where this is going to be?
Yes, the camp and performance will be at Open Bible Church in Boone. That's 1224 Hancock Drive. So as I said, we're on the road with our theater presently, so we are going around to lots of different places. But Open Bible Church has a large multipurpose room that will work well for the students for the camp part and the performance as well. So that is at Open Bible Church, 1224 Hancock Drive on March 20th. That Squirrel Girl Goes to College will be on, put on by the Boone Community Theater youth.
Well, you have yes?
You have is a registration fee for that, so I just want people to know up front. But you'll see that on our website if you're interested. Or you can, again, call the theater number, and we can get back to you with that information.
And what's your theater number again?
515-303-0393.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Lots of information there, and I hope that the right people are listening and can make it to auditions or sign up for Youth Camp or whatever. Or, of course, see Sabrina Fair this weekend.
We'd love to have you involved.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host for today, Susan Branson. Other voices you heard were Ursula Rudenberg, Danielle Zeno, Gary Mirka, Fran Amin, and Lori Haynes. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. Local Talk was engineered by Paul Hertz. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Unchained Melody by Al Hibner from the film Unchained. Local Talk, a radio production training workshop, as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Just look for the yellow donate button. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI meaningful and possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.